even if somebody stops using alcohol or drugs, there is the underlying issues around anxiety, social anxiety, depression that you have to address alongside this. And if families understand this, then they can help get the right support for the loved one.
This is Down to Earth Conversations, where we hear from ordinary people who are helping to bring a bit of heaven down to earth. Kia ora, welcome to another episode of Down to Earth Conversations with me, your host, Andy Dixon. I recently heard that Peter Harris, founder of the International Theology and Ecology Organisation, AROSHA, was coming to New Zealand, which I was pretty excited about, because AROSHA is an epic organisation exploring practical ways that theology and ecology intersect and helping churches and other organisations work to care for our planet and all it contains. Having heard that Peter was coming, I was then a bit gutted to realise that I had a family commitment that night, and while I enjoyed that, I didn't get to hear him speak when he was here in Christchurch. But all was not lost, because while Peter was here in New Zealand, episode 72 guest James Beck interviewed Peter for his podcast Ngāhere. That episode is out now and is a great listen. So if you care about how faith and creation care intersect, go check it out. I'll put some links in the show notes to that. Really worth your time. For those new to this podcast, it would be great to connect on social media. I'm downtoearth.conversations on both Facebook and Instagram, and I'll put those in the show notes as well. If you find these conversations helpful, then why don't you subscribe so that you can get kept up to date when new episodes come out? And if you are finding these conversations helpful, it'd mean a lot to me if you would consider telling someone else about the podcast, or even posting about it on your socials. It's really you guys that get the word out there. So thank you for the support. And yeah, I'd love you to keep doing that. But to today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with the wonderful Dr. Pauline Stewart. Pauline is an educator, a psychologist, also actually an Anglican priest. And when she was an age when many would be hanging up their work clothes, Pauline was starting up a charity to support the family and friends of people with alcohol or other drug habits. We talk about her time as a teacher, why she moved from that into psychology. We discuss her time working for the Ministry of Education as a psychologist, and we talk about Family Drug Support, the charity that Pauline founded to educate and support people whose loved ones are misusing alcohol or other drugs. We get a lot into evidence-based practice and what that means, and the opportunity that comes with AI, which was a fascinating part of the conversation as well. I was encouraged, impressed, and even a little bit surprised at times throughout the conversation. This is episode 89 of Down to Earth Conversations. Here's Dr. Pauline Stewart. So it's a privilege to be sitting with Dr. Pauline Stewart here today. Kia ora, Pauline. Welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora.
And for those who don't know who you are, do you want to just tell us a little bit about who is Pauline Stewart?
Oh, interesting question. For the purposes of this podcast, I would say I'm the founder and executive officer of Family Drug Support, which is a nationwide organisation based in Christchurch, providing assistance in many ways for people who are impacted by somebody else's alcohol or other drug misuse.
Mm-hmm. I always find I ask that question, and I think the younger a person is, the easier they find it to answer, because they don't have to pack as much life into yes, that sort of question.
Yes,
but
yes,
the drug support, family drug support, is something I'm very interested in chatting about, because, I mean, we work together at St. Barnabas Church, but I've heard bits and pieces. We've had a few conversations, but really looking forward to kind of unpacking some of that today. I guess before we get to that, what did you see yourself doing with life when you were a kid? What did you think you were going to grow up and do?
Well, I can remember at secondary school, principal saying to me that I wasn't quite bright enough to go to university, but that would I like to be a teacher or work in a bank? And I thought that's a fairly narrow range of activities. So I explored quite a few. I actually initially started as a teacher and I loved teaching. I taught both children who are deaf and I taught primary school and I was taught secondary school, including head of department at a large secondary school, while I was doing degrees at university through that time. So what I saw myself doing is something helping people, basically, love teaching. And then, of course, about 26 years ago, used all that knowledge to become a psychologist. And so for the last 26, 27 years, I've been a psychologist.
I find that fascinating and also horrific that someone would tell you that you're not intelligent enough to do X, Y, Z, so would you like to become a teacher? Because actually, teaching is such an important vocation. And you actually, I mean, we need people that know their stuff. I mean, even just to tell a kid that you're not bright enough, you can't do X, Y, Z, you know, that it just...
It was prefaced by, you've worked really hard and you've tried really hard, but you're not quite bright enough to do that.
Wow.
Mm.
I wonder what that principal would think of your PhD.
Well, I know what the principal thought because my sister arranged an afternoon tea a few years ago and asked the principal to come for the afternoon tea and myself. And she informed the principal very nicely at the afternoon tea that I had actually done a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a PhD and a second master's degree in counselling. And when the principal looked quite shocked, could obviously not remember me, and said, "Oh, I hope I wasn't a barrier to you." I said, "No, it just made me much more determined."
Wow. So. Yeah, yeah. So what prompted the shift from teaching to psychology?
I love teaching. I love being head of department. I felt that if I could use all the skills I had developed over 25 years to work on a more individual basis, I could continue working until the day I died. So I thought that this was probably a really good way to move into another field that could use what I'd done. So, and I absolutely loved the psychology work and loved being a psychologist and currently love being a psychologist, and all the things that I've done have informed what I'm doing now.
And so that took you, with your educational background, that actually took you back into that education space, didn't it?
It did, because I was working for the Ministry of Education as a senior psychologist, and especially in special needs and complex needs and families and behaviour support for 17 years in Southland. So yeah, I used all that I'd done in schools to inform my psychology work.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a board chair and I know how important roles like that are. And are increasingly becoming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I have amazing amounts of respect for people that do the sort of things that you were doing, because we just have so much need in our young people, in our children who, you know, haven't been given a great start at life and need some support to be able to get things going and in a good direction. So, yeah, I mean, what was, I guess, the most rewarding part about working in that Ministry of Education space?
I loved working for the Ministry of Education. I had an amazing team that I led, and I had an amazing team around me, that colleagues that I worked with. I worked in rural areas and city, town. I absolutely loved the job, and it fitted in very well with raising children. Yeah, and cool. Also, it fitted in very well because I farmed with my husband, and so we had a farm in Southland, and so it enabled me to be part of the farming community and part of our farm, as well as doing a full-time job.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, many strings to your bow.
And also working with the families to enable them to provide the best support for the young person their young person, and also working with schools to develop the skills in teachers, teacher aides, other people in education, so that they could provide also the best support. And so working with the family and the school together to integrate the very best support for a young person with complex needs.
Yeah. Which, yeah, I mean, like I say, that's just so important. Yeah, the number of kids I've seen who are just lost in the system.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've got a massive shortage of psychologists and counsellors and things working in the education space. So such an important role, and yeah, so great that you were able to do that and love it for so long. One of the main reasons I did want to chat to you was about family drug support. I was chatting with my parents last night saying that I was going to talk to you about this, and said, actually, I think Pauline started it when she was about your age. So, you know, come on.
I don't.
Yeah, so start up a charity. But I mean, how did that come about?
Well, in my private practice, because once I left the Ministry of Education, I developed a private practice, firstly in Southland and then moved to Christchurch and had the private practice in Christchurch. I was seeing a lot of people come to me for support around anxiety, depression. And when I really unpacked that with them, there was often a family member who had alcohol or other drug use, challenging alcohol or other drug use, and that was impacting on the person who came to me. And so I looked around New Zealand, looked around the world to see what was available with evidence-based support for impacted family members. And basically, I found basically nothing.
Yeah.
There were some services that work in a peer support way, but not a clinical way. And also I found that most of the services were about the focal person who had the alcohol or other drug misuse and not about the 10 to 12 people who are impacted by one person's alcohol or other drug use. And so I woke up one morning and I thought, I'm going to form an organisation to help those people. And what I thought very quickly, why would I just form it in Canterbury? Why not form it nationwide? So there was a lot of work around that to develop that. And how can I make the service available for everybody in New Zealand, irrespective of whether they in town, city, country, got children, anybody that can have that service?
I love that. I mean, that's a big vision from the start. And I love that, you know, you set yourself this challenge of going, well, I could just start in this little kind of way, but what if we didn't? You know, what if we looked bigger than that? And I mean, that's fantastic because you're helping more people by having had that attitude. Just in what you said, you talked about the peer support versus the clinical support. The peer support, is that more like, hey, we're also going through this kind of thing, let's help each other?
Yes, there's a lot of different peer support. You know, there's some different peer support services. That's where somebody who has lived experience and who's going to help other people who are having lived experience.
Yeah.
And that there's definitely a place for that, especially for the focal person who has alcohol or other drug use. That's our services. Many people who work with us, most of the people who work for FDS volunteers. We do have some paid employees, but most of those would have some loved experience, but we actually come up from a very evidence-based perspective, training accredited practitioners to provide the very best service to impacted family members. So it is different. It's quite different.
So it's not so much of a, you know, when I was going through this, this is what helped me. It's more actually, it's, you know, we've studied this. We know these are some of the things that help. These are some of the things that don't help.
Yes. Right. And we have a huge amount of resources, research, probably 1,000 peer-reviewed articles on impacted family members. We've done our own research through the 8 universities in New Zealand. We've done our own research through Research New Zealand on people in New Zealand and how many people are impacted. And we know around 40% of New Zealanders are impacted, 40%, which is huge, are impacted by somebody's alcohol or other drug use. And what we know is that people, because of concealed stigma, people are very reticent about reaching out for support. They don't want to move over the threshold of an alcohol or other drug service because they might be the school principal in a small town, they might be a nurse, they might be a doctor, they might be a lawyer, it might be their son or daughter who has alcohol or other drug use. And so they want a confidential service. And what we have developed over the last 4 years is nearly all our services is via telehealth. So it's around Zoom. And so people have the service delivered into their own home at a time that suits them and the impact, them and the practitioner. And so that service is hugely valued. Half of our referrals, people self-refer, half of the referrals come through the website, through areas in Auckland, Northland, Taranaki, all over New Zealand, because we've got practitioners all over New Zealand, but it's all done on telehealth, on Zoom.
Mm. So it's accessible for anybody that's got an internet connection, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Which, I mean, that's a huge barrier that's taken out of the way.
It's interesting because a lot of barriers are indicated by people, but we've not had anybody who hasn't been able to access our service through their phone or through a laptop. And the really good thing is that sometimes people will apply for the service and then somebody else, the husband or partner, comes on as well. So you're actually making that connection. So there's more than one person. It's usually one or two people.
Yeah.
And so you can get people on the same page. And so that's really another advantage.
Yeah, cool. I was reading the mission on the website, and it says to assist families and friends to deal with the use of alcohol and or other drugs in a way that strengthens relationships and achieves positive outcomes, which, I mean, my first thought was, I love how relational this is. You know, this is relationship centered. This isn't just about, you've got some issues, let me give you some tools to, you know, battle your issues. This is about, no, how do we form relationships? How do we grow relationships? How do we help you survive in relationship that's struggling?
What we do know is it's very important for impacted family members to have very good evidence-based information, because then they can make really good decisions. An example of that is that we know for people to move into recovery, 60% of people move into recovery without going into any treatment services or anything like that. They stop the habit. It's not a disease model. They stop the habit and they build a new life. But what they need is connection. They need hope. They need a new identity. They need meaning in their life, and they need empowerment or self-trust. And if family members know that, then all the things that people talk about, like codependency, and which is just, there's no evidence for those sort of things at all. But what we know is that there needs to be connection, there needs to be relationships. Even if the bridges have been burnt earlier, we help to family members to understand what's needed for the person to change their life.
That's fascinating, because like even just some of the things you said then, saying, you know, there's no evidence or there is evidence, some of that goes against kind of the popular story that's told, doesn't it? Do you find you come up against that a lot?
A lot, because in the 1930s, when some methods around disease model were actually developed, that was the only model. But what we know from research now is that a habit model is much more evidence-based, and we know how recovery happens. And that's really important that family members know that, so that they don't think the person has a disease for life and they can't change it. We never diss that model, but we actually know that there is really important information about how you can help people move into recovery. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, our service is to help impacted family members actually build the coping and resilience they need for what is often a long journey.
Yeah, yeah. So what does that actually look like in practice? You've talked about people accessing your support.
Well, they can call back. They can phone up and we can call them back. That's the first thing. They can go on our website that has excellent resources. They can have a single session consultation so they can see what their needs are, and that's generally via Zoom. We set that all up. And then if they want to, and most people do, move on to 5 counselling sessions. And during that session, they have an accredited practitioner who will listen to the story, help them with the information they need. It might be on chronic sorrow, the grief that they're experiencing, how they're going to deal with what is happening for them. We also look at coping. There are only 3 ways of coping, and how those cope, the advantages and disadvantages, looking at support. And we do really good data collection, so we know that the programs are actually really working. And we also do 3 monthly catch-ups around evaluation, so we know from our data what's actually happening and the changes that people are able to make through having done the program.
It's quite comprehensive, which, like you say, when someone's in for the long haul, they need that stability, they need that support. So it's great that you're doing more than just giving them some tools to help the other person, but you're actually giving them tools for themselves.
Absolutely, yes. I presented three papers at a conference in Rotterdam just recently, and actually talking to, there was 100 participants from 25 countries, and they were listening to the service that we provide. It is gold standard and very evidence-based. And that the impact on family members is not just in New Zealand, it's worldwide. And everybody I spoke to talked about having really evidence-based interventions or evidence-based. It's not just about having an assessment, because there's so little intervention that's available, there's so few programs that are available that actually listen to what the family member is going through and enable the family member to actually build their coping and resilience.
It seems, from my very limited experience of it, that a lot of the way things have been done in the past have been, this person has a problem, let's get them off to somewhere where they can sort out their problem. And I like that you're taking the approach of, actually, let's focus on the relationship and the support around them first, because if they're ever going to be able to get themselves out of it, they're going to need that love and connection and support, which, yeah, it's a mind shift, I guess, from
it is
what the public kind of expects, I guess.
Nearly everybody who comes onto any of our programs, their big concern is to get their loved one into treatment. But actually, most of the people who come onto the program have got person, loved one, somebody they care about, who actually is never going to go into any treatment. So, but changes can still be made. So it's really important that people build their coping resilience themselves for that. Most people don't go into any treatment, but stop the habit for a number of reasons.
And it's good that treatment's available for those that need it. But to give people hope that actually that's not the only solution here.
Absolutely.
Especially, do you say 60% don't?
Yes.
Wow, that's much higher than I would have expected.
They just stop the habit and actually change their lives. And there's a whole lot of things that they need to do. And the family members need to know about how recovery happens. They need to know how they can help this person, because in the end, they're there trying to cope themselves without any support. And often they don't want to disclose to anybody else, or they might tell one or two people, but actually it's a huge burden on their own mental health to actually have that.
You say you've done a lot of sort of work on making sure that it's working. What's some of the feedback that you're getting from those going through the programs?
Right from, it's completely changed the way we look at the person that we care about who has alcohol or other drug use, that this has been so good to have somebody non-judgmental who will listen to our story, that will work specifically with us on our story, not have us sit around and listen to other people's war stories, but actually will support us in our story and moving on through our journey, which is really important. We have wonderful feedback about our accredited practitioners who are highly trained, and that a lot of them are volunteers doing this, but highly trained. Mm-hmm. And that I've had, we know, because from our surveys, we know from some of the comments that people make that there's a whole lot of things that they had no idea about, around chronic sorrow, around concealed stigma, around how drugs impact people, how alcohol impacts people and the social acceptability of it, and yet it's really destroying families. So that's we get that feedback every day.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me like you've gone beyond treating the symptom to actually try to treat the thing that has caused the symptom to occur.
Yes.
Which, again, especially if there's that disease mindset of, you know, someone has the disease of alcoholism or whatever it is, it can be very easy to focus on the alcoholism is the problem. Mm. Whereas what I hear you saying is the alcoholism is a way to or the drug use is a way to cope with other things that are going on.
And we know this from excellent research that unless, even if somebody stops using alcohol or other drugs, there is the underlying issues around anxiety, social anxiety, depression that you have to address alongside this. And if families understand this, then they can help get the right support for the loved one, the person that they know. We have actually just introduced a youth program. So up until now, we've been working with adults. So it might be a person's partner, it might be a person's adult children, a whole range of people come to us for support. But we've just developed a youth program for 16 to 24 year olds who are impacted by parental or friend or flatmates, alcohol or other drug misuse. It's a free program. People just self-refer through our website. We have an amazing five-session program for them. We also do a single session if they want, but the five-session program with excellent resources, and that's all been developed alongside young people. So that's a really, really great program. And for a lot of youth, they're happy to work on with their cell phone or a laptop to do that counselling, and they don't really want to go into any service.
The organisation seems like it's kind of humming now. There's a lot going on, developing youth programs, you know, spreading things wider so you can help more people. We talked about the great vision that you had at the start. What were the actual, those first couple of years actually like? Because I imagine, given that it's a charity and given you had this big vision, you know, you've got this desire to help people, but you've also got to sell the idea to people. You've got grant applications, you've got to find money from somewhere, you've got to find volunteers. You know, how did all that work? What was that like?
I think sometimes you have to have a lot of faith that there is going to be solutions, and you have to work to find those solutions alongside that underlying faith. And so for me, that was very important. You know, when I look back now and I think about funding, strategic plans, board of governance, practitioners, training, marketing, just that's about a quarter of what I was faced with right from the beginning. And I look to now where I've got the most amazing team around me, a wonderful board of governance, and you know, 25 accredited practitioners, mostly volunteers, excellent world-class programs. I just sometimes I wonder, how did I get here? I guess at the moment I'm thinking about next steps, which is quite interesting, thinking about next steps. And I'm working very hard at the moment around AI and actually being able to have ChatGPT or one of the other processing systems with a fantastic empathetic avatar on our website so that we are able to help people who want to reach out in that way. It's not up and going yet. There's a lot of work that we're doing in the background to do that, and that is leading edge stuff. That's daily leading edge stuff. So I guess my role is to have the vision and to help to get the right people around to implement that vision, because there's still a lot to do.
That's fascinating to me, because like a lot of people your age, if they've heard of AI, it's probably a thing that they're quite fearful of. You know, this new thing that's changing and I don't understand it. And I love that you're going, what an opportunity we've got here.
Oh, it's an amazing opportunity. Yesterday I was in a meeting and the AI took the meeting note, the minutes, and just produced them straight away. And they were 99% accurate. We had a transcript of the minutes straight out of the meeting, and even that surprised me. But there's just so much opportunity to interact and get and actually help people get the support they need using AI. There's so much coming out every day. It's not something to be that I'm fearful about. It's something that I want to use. It is the oil. It is the same as oil in the olden days. You know, ChatGPT or any AI system is going to be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of those things that there's always going to be somebody who's going to use it for
unhelpful purposes. Absolutely.
But actually, that happens with any tool.
Yeah, that happened with the oil and everything.
Yeah. And what an opportunity to to be able to help more people.
Yes, and that's the background of it. How can we help more people who may not have the resources, who really want support, who don't just want an assessment, they want actually best practice intervention to help them build coping and resilience.
Mm. How have you got volunteers on board? You talk about these volunteers that help do the sessions and things. I'm assuming these are people who are also counsellors and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of it's word of mouth. It was hard at the beginning. It's word of mouth. Often people who know our wonderful volunteers will contact me and say, I'd love to be trained as an accredited practitioner. It's talking to a lot of groups. For the youth program, I probably have been around 26, 27 organisations in the last 3 or 4 months to tell them about a youth program. So it's letting people know. And for the training that we do, we have a very high standard for people to come in to do the training. And so that means their accreditation process after they've done the training, we only have accredited practitioners, not people that have just been to training. So we know that we have a really good handle and very good supervision on the people that we work with. So yeah, it's often word of mouth, but just talking to people and saying, would you like to do this? Does this spin your wheels? Because yeah, once people come in and get into this field, they're generally really passionate about it.
Yeah, I guess that was my next question, was what's the feedback you get from those volunteers?
It's amazing, because a lot of them are people in private practice, or they've just done a psychology degree, or they're social workers, and they do the training that we provide, which is international training, but we provide it here in Christchurch, so people come to Christchurch to do it, and they just are blown away by the evidence base, they're blown away by the resources, they're blown away by the fact that they can really help impacted family members. Yeah. And although it's a program, every single person who comes on is different, so every program is different.
Yeah. You also said that with the youth program, it's going to be free.
Mm.
And I read on the website that pretty much everything you do is either free or very minimal cost.
Mm.
How is that funded? Are you just really good at grant applications?
We've done a lot of grant applications. There are some organisations that have supported us very well. Last year, we had a great deal of success with Te Whiti Ora, Ministry of Health. They understand the programs that we're running, and because they're run on, use telehealth, because they're accessible to everyone, because they're low cost or no cost, because we've got evidence base, because we've got accredited practitioners, they are starting to support us. And that is that's been a game changer. And the reason that's been a game changer, that they've understood what health and well-being is about, not just for the focal person, but the 10 to 12 people around them.
Yeah.
That's been a game changer, because it's built in sustainability for the organisation. And so not all our time is taken up with grants and donations and things like that, which we still really need for a wide range of things. But actually we've got that underlying regular funding. So yes. And we just have to quite keep proving to the Ministry of Health that we've got a fantastic program helping.
Is that really rewarding, having started this thing from scratch and then having the Ministry of Health going, great, we want to support this?
Incredibly rewarding. Incredibly rewarding. Yes, I couldn't say how rewarding it is. And also developing a relationship with people who are providing this funding, so that they know what we're doing next and how we're doing it. So keeping that relationship going is really important, yes.
And I guess having that more stable kind of space, more stable kind of income, is helpful for you thinking of, you know, what happens when I get to the stage where actually I need to hand some things over. I mean, at this stage, that seems maybe like when you're in your coffin.
No, it's before that, slightly before that. But I do find that now I can think of succession planning, whereas I couldn't think of succession planning earlier. And I think succession planning is really imperative. I mean, even working alongside someone to build that succession planning in, and I'm always doing that, but now it looks more likely that I can do it. I'm also on the board and consulting and things like that. So that will carry on.
That succession planning is so important, isn't it? Because you see so many little charities that are so built around the person who started it that when that person steps out of that, that kind of ceases to exist.
I think the other thing that's really important is I've got an absolute dream team around me. I come to work and I just think, how can I have been so lucky to have got the people with the skills around me? And yeah, that management of the team is very important to me, that people are job crafting in a really good way,
yeah.
And that they're just amazing people. So that's also really good for me. I also take on an intern, and I try to take on interns who have lived experience that we can help develop their skills and their journey. And that's quite important to me too. So yeah, very fortunate.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How can people support what you do?
They can support by telling people that we're available, that what we provide, that we're there to help impacted family members, to not be whakamara and ashamed, to reach out to get support, because the support is excellent. They can help on our website. They can donate. That's always helpful, and there's always a huge number of things that we can use those donations for. Or they can pay it forward for somebody that the adult programs generally cost for the whole 5 counselling sessions are around $200, which is very low cost.
Amazing,
but
yeah.
For some people who aren't able to afford that, we have $95 for 5 counselling sessions, and we've never turned anybody away. So people can pay it forward and say, I would like to support somebody to do a program with you. And that's really great. And just letting people know about our service, both for adults who are impacted and also for young people who are impacted, and help them step through to refer themselves via the website is really important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the website for people to be able to find
the website? Is if you just put in Family Drug Support New Zealand, you will come onto our website.
Excellent.
With all the resources that are there.
Great.
And there's some great resources there for people to just see the sort of work that we do as well. And you can apply online.
Mm-hmm.
And many services have very long waiting lists. We don't. If somebody applies online, generally within 1 or 2 weeks, they will be working with an accredited practitioner.
That's phenomenal.
Mm.
Again, having experience of trying to get kids seen in the education system, you know, sometimes the waiting list can be 6 months or longer, but that's fantastic. So I'll put that link in the show notes as well, so people can just scroll down and click and go through. I was looking through the website, and like you say, it's just so filled with amazing resources.
Mm.
If all you did was go to the website and read stuff, you would just be so much better off.
Yeah.
And yet you've got all this other one-on-one support and things like that too. So yeah, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your heart for people and your wanting to support relationship and family, and thank you for what you're doing to bring a bit of heaven down to earth.
Thank you, Andy.
Hello, hello heaven. Well, I hear you whisper to come near.
I am so grateful for this corridor. I have to be honest, until I met Pauline, I really hadn't considered just how many people are impacted by these negative habits that people fall into. And here is Pauline stepping into that space and making a difference. So thank you, Pauline, for who you are, for what you do. Here is a blessing for you. Pauline, as you spend so much time supporting the families of others, may you also know the joy of relationship with your own whānau, experiencing connection and beauty and peace as you love one another. May Family Drug Support continue to find support from those with the power to open the purse strings. May you find favour with those in positions of power that your work might expand to support even more people, that this important work would carry on far beyond your years. May you continue to love what you do and find life and love in the midst of it. May it be a joy to see lives changed and people heal. May you continue to find yourself surrounded by outstanding humans who have caught the vision of what you've started, people who can carry you when you're limping and celebrate with you in your joy. May your exploration into new technologies open many doors to enable you to help many more people, spreading your messages of hope throughout the country and the world. And lastly, may you know you are seen, you are heard, and you are loved. Thanks to Strawn for the music and Rangi for the karakia. Join me next time when I talk to Kaz and Em, the hosts of the podcast The Bloody Bible. The Bloody Bible explores biblical texts of violence and crime, linking those to true crime stories of our day in an effort to highlight attitudes and behaviours present in these biblical stories that are still informing parts of life and culture today. We talk about how they became interested in this work, what they see as the most problematic attitudes and behaviours from these stories that they still see today, and what we can do to change things. It's a brilliant discussion with two amazing wahine. Until then, me inoi tātou.
E tō mātou matua i te rangi, kia tapu tō ingoa, kia tau mai tō rangatiratanga, kia mea te tau e pai ai ki runga ki te whenua, kia rite anō ki tō te rangi. Humai kia mātou ai nei, he taro mā mātou mō tēnei rā. Mūro o mātou hara, me mātou hoki e muru nei i o te hunga. E hara ana kia mātou, aua hoki mātou e kawea kia whakawaia. Engari whakorangi a mātou i te kino mātou.